We watched the eloquent echo as fathers, brothers and lovers fought on razor edge of life or death, and were silent if the echo, after battle, moved steadily eastwards towards enemy territory.
A moment of bang. And then the whole aircraft just exploded.
Pilot Officer Hopkins fired forth and further bits and pieces fell off the machine. Although the machine was not actually seen to crash in the water, by this time it was fully ablaze.
You would wait for the call signs at the leads. You knew one of the corporals was going out with one of the pilots, and our boy didn't come. That was terrible. But that's war.
Inside the Battle of Britain, from the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. It's mid-September 1940. Fighting in the Battle of Britain is intense and grueling, and the destruction of the Blitz is taking a huge toll on civilian life. But as the days grow shorter and the autumn weather sets in, it's becoming increasingly clear that the Germans have failed to destroy the Royal Air Force and that they won't be able to launch their planned invasion of Britain. I'm Victoria Taylor, a military historian specialising in British and German aviation. In this episode, we'll find out what Britain's success in the Battle of Britain against the seemingly unstoppable Luftwaffe meant, even though there was still nearly 5 years of fighting ahead. We'll also hear from some of those who fought in the skies and from people whose contributions to the battle are less well known. The many behind the few. Episode 5, Victory. The British marked the 31st of October 1940 as the end of the Battle of Britain, the last day of daytime raids by the German Air Force. However, it was the 15th of September, a day of extremely heavy fighting, now commemorated as Battle of Britain Day, which is regarded as the turning point in the battle. Christoph Bergs is a historian who runs the Military Aviation History YouTube channel.
So on the 15th of September, the Luftwaffe sent out their largest attack on London. It can be considered as sort of their final push. Throughout the whole day, you have attacks that are being made, and the Luftwaffe really hoped that the RAF would be unable to cope with this. They hoped that the RAF was a spent force. It wasn't. And although the Germans initially think that they have won the battle, or that they have won the day and that they see the day as a success, they realize pretty soon afterwards that this is a fight that has no end.
The Luftwaffe send 1,000 aircraft over Britain in the largest attack on London so far. 23 RAF squadrons are scrambled to take them on. Fighter Command lose 26 aircraft and 13 pilots in the onslaught, but 56 Luftwaffe aircraft are destroyed in the process, with 81 pilots killed. Fighter Command are relieved to learn that their losses are eclipsed by German ones on the 15th, but the RAF's initial claim of 185 Luftwaffe aircraft was massively overstated. Sadly, the German bombers do succeed in killing 57 civilians in the daylight raid on London. Even though the statistics were starting to look more favourable for Fighter Command, the battle is still heavy with immense destruction, loss and death.
15th of September 1940, 504 Squadron, location was over London, enemy casualties, one Dornier 215 destroyed, one Dornier 215 damaged, our casualties, one Hurricane missing, one Cat 2.
The combat reports written by the RAF airmen at the time and read for us by pilots serving with the RAF aerobatic team, the Red Arrows, describe the intensity of the fighting.
In the attack made by number 504 Squadron, I attacked the right flank machine from quarter to astern. Pieces flew from the wing and a flame appeared but went out again. After breaking away, I climbed up to a single Dornier 215 and made two quarter attacks. Pieces flew off My windscreen was now splashed with black oil. I attacked for a third time, and a member of the crew bailed out. On the fourth attack from the port beam, a jar shook my starboard wing as I passed over the enemy aircraft and I went into an uncontrollable spin. I think the enemy aircraft must have exploded beneath me. I bailed out. As I landed, I saw the Dornier hit the ground outside Victoria Street Station, half a mile away. Sergeant R.T. Holmes.
Sergeant Ray Holmes admitted later that this collision was not accidental. He'd actually deliberately rammed the German plane, as he believed it was heading towards Buckingham Palace. A couple of days later, Hitler indefinitely postpones Operation Sea Lion, the Wehrmacht's plan to invade Britain. Although the aerial offensive and the bombardment of the Blitz continue, the threat of imminent occupation has passed. In previous episodes, we've looked at how, although Britain was the last bastion of Allied resistance against the Germans, it wasn't quite as heavily outnumbered as is often said. But what were the crucial factors that helped it to victory? Well, one of them was the Dowding system. This defensive network was named for Air Chief Marshal Hugh Dowding, Fighter Command's Commander-in-Chief, who had masterminded it. Christoph Bergs explains.
The Dowding system was very modern in the way that it was the most advanced integrated air defense system at the time. So the Dowding system gave the RAF an advantage over the Luftwaffe because it essentially connects two different aspects. It lifts the fog of war. You had early warning, and then the Observer Corps, of course, could give you accurate numbers on the enemy's force and their approach, and that in itself is already a tremendous advantage. And the second aspect really builds on top of this, because you can orchestrate quite a flexible but still a centrally organized defense and response to this incoming threat. And that gives you just such an advantage of choosing when, where, and how you will fight, and that is really priceless.
The Dowding system was an intricate communications web that sent information on the invading force's number, height, location, and destination to Fighter Command's operations rooms. It used two-way radio, reports from the Observer Corps, radar, and telephone links between radar operators to collect and communicate this life-or-death information in real time. It was then used to scramble fighter squadrons and to guide anti-aircraft fire, searchlights, barrage balloons, the whole defensive apparatus Britain had at its disposal. No other country had anything this sophisticated in operation at the time. One crucial element of the Dowding system was the dual radar system installed around Britain's coastline. Chainholm, which had longer range, and Chainholm Low, which covered lower altitudes closer to home, to catch enemy aircraft literally flying under the radar. Christoph Bergs again.
Radar played a tremendous role in the Battle of Britain because it gives you an advantage. It allows the RAF to be alerted of an attacking Luftwaffe fleet well in advance, actually when they were still mustering over France, really. And this provides them then with time to make an adequate response. And you cannot really put a price on that time. It's absolutely vital because it gets everybody ready, alert, and of course prepared then before you even see a single enemy aircraft.
Once enemy aircraft were over British soil, the volunteers of the Observer Corps, the eyes and ears of the RAF, provided crucial visual information to the defence.
Let's see the Spitfires above. 1, 2, 3.
Yes, I can see.
Right. Yes. Leading below him, his back. He's going down his lane.
They were quite a critical element in the Dowding system because they compensated for certain things that Chainholm, for example, couldn't do. And that is counting and visually identifying the aircraft coming over the channel. For example, is it a bomber? Is it a fighter?
Oh no, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 Spitfires. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Yes, that's
it. And also providing constant updates on the heading of these aircraft. There were actually many challenges that the RAF personnel had when it came to operating the Dowding system. I mean, you really got to, you know, give credit to the women and men who made sure that it worked. I think the main challenge really within the system is communication. So how do you pass the precise information like altitude, numbers, heading, along the communication channels from the observer corps, from the radar, over to the HQs and then over to the squadrons. And then also keep pilots appraised and up to date as they climb towards the Luftwaffe, right? And this is pretty much a grown-up version of that children's game, Pass the Message. But you don't want the information getting lost or garbled. And that in itself is a big challenge. And there were still a few hang-ups in the summer of 1940, but of course, with increasing experience and training, the RAF got very good at it.
Members of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, popularly known as the WAFs, played a vital role in this sophisticated communication system and took on many other jobs in the defence of Britain. By the summer of 1940, there were several thousand WAFs supporting their male colleagues in the Royal Air Force. Sally McGlone is a former RAF officer and historian, specialising in the role of women in military and aviation. She says women took on roles they'd never been allowed to fill before.
There were radar operators and plotters, and these were the ladies that would deal with all the information that was coming in from the observer corps on where the aircraft were, how high they were when they were spotted by the observers, and all this information would be input into the groups who were the units that looked after different areas of the United Kingdom, and the women would plot the positions of the Luftwaffe aircraft on huge maps in operations rooms, which were down at the bottom of buildings, heavily fortified quite often. And they would plot number of aircraft that had been seen, whether they were friendly or enemy aircraft, and the height that they were flying at. So all this information had to be done really quickly, really methodically, and very precisely. So they were doing those jobs, but they were also doing telephonist roles, engineering support roles, mechanical engineering on the aircraft, and then meteorological officers.
Jackie Mogridge was only 17 when war broke out. She joined the WAF and was recruited for training in a secret operation. None of the recruits were told what they were training for. She described her experiences in a book, Spitfire Girl, My Life in the Sky. Extracts from it are read for us by the actress Sue Holderness.
The blobs of light were finally baptised as echoes. The addition of a compass scale on the locating control failed to hint to us the nature of our work. By the third week, those of us still remaining on the course could give the compass bearing and approximate distance of any echo appearing on the screen. Not, we thought, a particularly commendable achievement. On the last day of the course, we gathered in the lecture hall for the unveiling ceremony. The commanding officer thanked us for our patience. Our work was, of course, radar interception. The echoes would be in future enemy aircraft approaching the coasts of Britain. We left the lecture rooms happily, boredom and restlessness gone. Our work was simple but vital. Women rarely ask for more.
Catherine Duplat Taylor was also in the WAF, working in the operations room. Deep underground, in a base beneath Dover Castle, she plotted aircraft locations on a table map, guiding the RAF's Air Sea Rescue Service to find casualties and saving the lives of hundreds of pilots.
The Royal Observer Corps would transmit to the operations room, and we would pick up the coordinates, put down your marker where the map reference is. You had a stand, and you put on the stand number that had been given that particular aircraft or wing or squadron. Then it would be how many were in it, and then it would be the height they were flying at. The hour was divided into red, yellow and blue sections, and according to what the colour was on the clock, that coloured arrow you used, so that the officer who was controlling the aircraft could see from that when the aircraft took off, how long they'd been in the air, and which direction they were going in.
The relationship between those in the air and on the ground felt intimate as they followed the pilot's every move, as Jackie Mogridge and Catherine Duplat-Taylor both recall.
In these huts, isolated and stark, we grappled abstractedly with the enemy. Night and day, we evoked evil spirits from the ether. Like spiritualists purging a malignant ectoplasm, we hunted their echoes on our screens. Once spotted, their ethereal path was plotted, analysed, and telephoned through to central control. Minutes later, a new echo would appear on our screens as Royal Air Force fighters rose to intercept. With mounting tension and in silence, broken only by the clipped voice of the plotter telltaling central control of the evasions of the enemy, we would watch the silent drama unfolding from our screen. Sometimes, the opposing echoes joined without equivocation in a perfect interception as the hunters found their foes, or slid past each other like strangers as the enemy skulked cleverly in the clouds. A violent volte-face of the enemy's echo would bring a smile to our faces and jibe to our tongues on the few occasions that he turned and fled for home. Anxiously, we appraised the results of our work until two echoes joined in combat in a single oscillating blur that told of tally-ho, twisting evasion, screaming engines, the shrill rat-a-tat-tat of machine guns, or the throatier bark of cannon. We watched the eloquent echo as fathers, brothers and lovers fought on razor edge of life or death, and were silent if the echo, after battle, moved steadily eastwards towards enemy territory, leaving behind a dying echo that remained stationary for a few seconds before fading. The life it represented faded into oblivion.
You knew the call sign, usually, of the boy you were dancing with the night before. And you would wait for the call signs of the lads you knew. As they came over the North Sea, they'd increase height, so that they came within the scope of the radar. And you'd hear their call sign, and you'd say, oh, that's Johnny, and that's Brian, and I remember one of the corporals was going out with one of the pilots, and her boy didn't come. That was terrible. But there you are, that's war.
As the RAF sent more men to the front line, women took on ever more diverse roles, including operating the barrage balloons in the RAF's Balloon Command to protect Britain's bigger cities from aerial attack. The balloons, filled with helium and bigger than a double-decker bus, were operated on chains from a tractor and were moved to wherever raids were expected. It was physically hard and dangerous work, but Sally McGlone says the barrage balloons played an important role in the defence of Britain, forcing enemy bombers to higher altitudes where the radar could detect them and from where their bomb targeting would be less accurate.
The idea was they prevented Luftwaffe aircraft from getting directly over the cities. If an aircraft flew into the chains, which were very difficult to see when you're travelling 250, 300 miles an hour, and a lot of planes would crash into them and they would be tangled up. The barrage balloon operators were stationed all over the country, mainly around the bigger cities, the industrial towns, and it was their role to operate these huge, great big balloons, and they would be looking for damage to them and repairing them. And they'd spend months and months out in the freezing cold and the rain in the middle of winter, hoisting these balloons up and down, moving the next day, hoisting them up and down. So it was hard work and it was a lot of physical work, but it was something that the women were very proud of doing.
Women in the WAF could fulfil almost any role except for flying. But some women did in fact fly during the Battle of Britain, in a civilian organisation called the Air Transport Auxiliary. Although most ATA pilots were men who had been declared not fit for combat flight, the ban on women flying military aircraft was partially lifted by January 1940, and the first 8 female ATA pilots started working for them. Sally McGlone explains.
They would provide all the logistics support and delivery of aircraft to and from the factories to the RAF operational squadrons. And they also delivered to the Royal Navy. So they were essentially supporting the Air Force and the Royal Navy, and they would transport and ferry aircraft so that the RAF pilots weren't having to do the work themselves. Without the Air Transport Auxiliary, delivering aircraft to and from the factories. And I say to and from the factories, they would be flown from one of the ferry pools in the UK, pick up a Spitfire, and they'd take it to an operational airfield, drop it off, and then they'd find their own way back. They were given a rail warrant. They'd find their way back to the ferry pool that they started from. But without the Air Transport Auxiliary providing the support and delivering all the aircraft to the flying squadrons, you wouldn't have been able to release the pilots to fly operationally, actually in the Battle of Britain. So for me, I think that the Air Transport Auxiliary were intrinsically important in the role that they carried out and the support that they gave to the Royal Air Force and the Fleet Air Arm. And they did contribute a huge amount to the victory of the Battle of Britain.
This view of the ATA's importance was shared by Lord Beaverbrook, the Minister of Aircraft Production during the Battle of Britain. He said the ATA sustained and supported the RAF in the Battle of Britain, describing the ATA pilots as soldiers fighting in the struggle just as completely as if they had been engaged on the battlefront. The female pilots were initially viewed with some suspicion, and German propaganda also mocked Britain's mobilisation of women power to ferry RAF aircraft. However, Sally McGlone says that the female pilots soon became hugely popular.
Initially, when the first females were recruited in the Air Transport Auxiliary, there were letters to the Times saying, these women don't have the intelligence to be cleaning a floor, let alone flying an aircraft. They should be behind the kitchen sink. And there was a lot of animosity towards them. And I guess suspicion from some of the male pilots as well. These women were coming in and almost usurping them from their roles. But once they started delivering the aircraft and they proved that they could deliver the aircraft as safely and as professionally as the male pilots, and their safety figures were actually better than those of the male pilots if you do a comparison ratio. But once they proved their mettle, the opinion changed significantly and they became the it girls. They were championed in the newspapers. There were Post magazine, Life magazine. There were articles written about the Air Transport Auxiliary, but in particular about the female pilots. There's a very, very famous image of a lady called Maureen Dunlop, and she's just stepped out of her aircraft and she's got long dark hair and she's pushing it back with her hand. That became a really iconic image. So they were lauded. They were trailblazers. They were doing something completely out of the ordinary to anything that any other females had ever done before in wartime. So a really exciting time, as well as being exceptionally dangerous. They were very brave. They were flying without any navigation aids or any radios. So, you know, you can't underestimate the impact that they had and the avenues that they've opened up for women to be involved in flying and to pursue careers in flying post-World War II.
The young Jackie Mogridge was one of those who longed to fly. She was recruited to join the ATA in July 1940, the youngest female pilot at the time. Although she wasn't allowed to fly Spitfires during the Battle of Britain, Those restrictions on women were lifted in 1941, when she got her first chance to pilot one. She went on to fly more than 1,500 aircraft of 83 different types, but had a particular affinity with the Spitfire.
The Spitfire, a machine with the simplicity of features of a fine woman, stood outside the hangar basking as proudly as a thoroughbred in the warm sunshine. I clambered into the cockpit as warily as a rider mounting a highly spirited stallion and sat gazing absently at the instruments. It seemed the most natural thing in the world to be sitting there in the cockpit, as though my entire life had led to this moment. I started up, inexpertly, and felt the power coursing through the Spitfire's frame and registering on the instruments. A little awed, but stimulated by the urgent throb of the Merlin engine that seemed to tremble with eagerness to be free in its own element, I taxied cautiously to the downwind end of the field. The brakes were touchy, and recalling the warnings of my colleagues, I used them sparingly. The Spitfire is notoriously nose-heavy on the ground. A few seconds later, I found myself soaring through the air in a machine that made poetry of flight. Carefully, I familiarized myself with the controls as the ground fell away at fantastic speed and felt exhilarated by the sensitive response. Singing with joy, I dived and climbed and spiraled around broken clouds before turning on course. I landed uneventfully at Turn Hill, a fighter squadron base, and climbed out with spurious nonchalance as fighter pilots, sunning on the grass and awaiting the call to battle, waved and wolf-whistled in welcome. With an easy camaraderie, I waved back, for after all, I was almost one of them.
Now entering the final weeks of the Battle of Britain, Fighter Command needed to make use of every last person fit to serve to combat the intense attack of the Blitz. Fighting over home territory had its advantages, however. Those who were lightly injured, like Ludwig Martel, who was shot down in October but managed to land his plane in England, were back in the air again pretty fast.
10 days later, I was flying again. That was the idea of my CO. Said, Ludwig, sooner the go, the better. And I did.
For others, such as Geoffrey Page, a Hurricane pilot with 56 Squadron, who bailed out after he was hit by enemy fire over the Channel, the injuries they sustained were life-changing.
I'd been heard an almost bang, and then the whole aircraft just exploded. The beauty of the excellent Royal Air Force training came to my rescue, and I instinctively carried out the drill of releasing the harness that strapped me to my seat. I kicked the flying control column that popped me out of the aircraft like a cork out of a toy gun. My hands got a terrible burning, and face as well. My mouth and nose were saved by my oxygen mask. I remember seeing my right arm extended. I sort of looked at it. My brain ordered it to bring it in and pull the metal ring of the ripcord on the parachute. And that was agony because this cold metal ring and badly burned hand, it's like an electric shock. You don't have a choice. You've got to pull the thing. So I then found myself floating down, and I noticed my left shoe and my trousers had been blown off completely by the explosion. And I could hear the fight going on all around. It took me, I suppose, about 10 minutes to float down into the water. There were various problems I had. Well, my face was beginning to swell up from the burns by this point. I couldn't get my helmet off. I set off for the distance, but my eyesight was beginning not to fail, but my swollen eyelids and everything begin to close up, so the distant view of England, which I can see is quite a few miles away, was getting more and more blurred. Then after a while, I heard more than saw a boat. They kept on asking me questions. By this time, I'd been swimming for about half an hour. So when they said to me, "Are you a Jerry?" I'm afraid I let loose with every rude four-letter word I could think of. That immediately assured them that I was an RAF officer. And they picked me out of the water.
Geoffrey Page survived his life-threatening injuries and, along with other young pilots who'd been badly burned, became a founding member of the Guinea Pig Club, a group of patients who had experimental, cutting-edge plastic surgery by the renowned surgeon Archibald Mackindoe. Despite the damage to his hands and face, after 15 operations, Geoffrey Page returned to the cockpit in 1942 as a fighter pilot once more. The Battle of Britain saw countless examples of incredible heroism by the pilots, and their network of supporters demonstrated dedication to duty and bravery, overcoming fear and adversity. Due to their grit and determination, the RAF was victorious in repelling the invading Luftwaffe, successfully forcing the indefinite postponement of Operation Sea Lion. It was undeniably a remarkable accomplishment, but the fighting would continue for another 5 years. Rather than being a resounding military victory for Britain, the ultimate value of the Battle of Britain lay in demonstrating that German victory was not inevitable in the Second World War. Historian Christoph Bergs says that one reason the Germans failed was that the campaign was not one that the Luftwaffe was suited to.
One thing that I sometimes find missing in the discussion is that, as unusual as it sounds nowadays, with the benefit of hindsight, the Luftwaffe really doesn't see Great Britain as a potential obstacle until about 1938. So that's a year before the war starts. And we know this very clearly nowadays from the documents at the time. The Luftwaffe was full on in preparing a regional war against their most immediate rivals, and that was France and that was Poland. And that's one reason why they completely skip over, for example, their development of their first generation of heavy bombers. So the Luftwaffe was not built for something like the Battle of Britain. It was built for the Battle of Poland, it was built for the Battle of France, maybe even for the invasion of the Soviet Union 1 year later. If you put the Luftwaffe outside of that scenario, it's not going to perform the same way.
Even if it wasn't a victory that spelled the beginning of the end of the war, the Battle of Britain was a pivotal battle. Its importance is clear, not only in its propaganda value and public speeches, but in the private correspondences between world leaders. In telegrams to the American President Franklin D. Roosevelt during the Battle of Britain, Winston Churchill urgently asked the President to send over military equipment and promises that he meant every word of his public speeches, that Britain will not surrender or hand the precious weapons over to the enemy. As Christoph Berg says, in the wake of the defeat of continental Europe, Britain had to persist.
The Battle of Britain is perhaps the first example of where the German war machine was really put on a back foot and surprised that it was stopped. Now, of course, it was a very special campaign. It was a very special event in the sense that it didn't play out exactly the way that Germany had planned to wage a campaign. They always wanted to have a ground offensive. They were a continental army. And this battle is not happening in their comfort zone. And them losing it, of course, the European continent is still largely dominated by Germany and will be for the next 4 years. But it does send a sign. And I think it's also tremendously important for Britain and the Allies themselves because they can show, you know, we still have that bastion in Europe where we can then eventually also launch the liberation of Europe in itself 4 years later on.
The Battle of Britain had been a grueling aerial campaign, marred by the tragic loss of life, debilitating injuries, and lifelong trauma for some of the young men who had taken part in it. Even after it, the prospect of victory in the Second World War remained a light at the end of a long tunnel ahead. However, it had been the superhuman efforts of the fighter pilots, bomber crews, ground crews and auxiliary personnel that kept that light alive. The Battle of Britain is ultimately a human story of endurance, and it is that which makes it resonate in our memory to this day. The next episode, which will be released on Battle of Britain Day, is a special episode. We'll be bringing you an original audio drama written for the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund to mark the 80th anniversary of the battle. Matthew Wignall's play, A Gingerbread Man in the RAF, won an international competition for new writing, inspired by the stories of those who lived and served in the Battle of Britain. You'll hear it here for the first time. This series is a Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund production made by Chalk and Blade. It is co-written and presented by me, Victoria Taylor. The producer is Eva Krizyak. The mix and theme music are by Alex Portfelix, and the executive producers are Laura Sheeta and Logan Armandoni. The oral history clips with Geoffrey Page and Ludwig Martel are courtesy of the Imperial War Museum. The recording with Catherine Duplat-Taylor is courtesy of the RAF Museum. The combat report extracts, which are held at the National Archives, were read by Red 10 Squadron Leader Adam Collins and Red 5 Flight Lieutenant David Simmons from the RAF aerobatic team, the Red Arrows. The extracts from Spitfire Girl, My Life in the Sky, are read by actress Sue Holderness, written by Jackie Mockridge and published by Head of Zeus. The book is available to purchase in paperback and ebook. The historical consultant is Stuart Hadaway at the Royal Air Force Air Historical Branch.
This podcast is brought to you by the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund, the RAF's leading welfare charity. We are there for all members of the RAF family in their time of need, from those serving today to former members of the RAF, as well as their partners and dependent children. If you know of someone who might need some support, or to find out more, please visit our website, rafbf.org.